The Word of Mouth podcast is brought to you by
Dartmouth Hitchcock. Imagine nationally ranked healthcare in your community.
With convenient locations throughout northern New England.
World-class providers are closer than you think. Visit dartmouthhitchcock.org to learn more.
Dartmouth Hitchcock is here.
Word of Mouth.
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 Word of
Mouth.
This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. Overdose deaths involving opioid painkillers quadrupled between 1999 and 2011, hitting a record 18,893 in 2014. The grim, startling statistics amount to an epidemic that local, state, and federal agencies and institutions are scrambling to stem. Since 2011, a cascade of regulations, policy initiatives, and restrictions, including close monitoring of prescribers, limits on doses, and crackdowns on so-called pill mills. The goal is to stop dependency before it begins and limit access to addicts. What do these restrictions on painkillers mean for the estimated 25 million Americans who suffer daily with pain, many for decades? Some of whom shared their story with our guest, Christopher Zara. He's news editor at Fast Company and reported on how the crackdown on opioids has affected patients with chronic pain. He wrote a piece called Treated Like Addicts for Vice. Christopher, welcome to Word of Mouth.
Hi, Virginia. Thank you for having me.
Well, you talked to several people who are suffering from chronic pain. Pick one of them, Cindy Lau. You spoke with a woman named Jacqueline Meltzer. Tell us how the crisis is affecting them.
Sure. I mean, I can start with Cindy because she had, I think, the most salient story of the folks I spoke with. She suffered from a very rare spinal condition that was the result of some surgeries that she had, and it's the kind of condition where there's no cure for it. So you have a situation where you can expect a lifetime of pain. And she falls into a bucket that I think is often missed when we talk about the opioid situation. She's tried every treatment imaginable. I mean, she even drank holy water from France to try to combat her pain, and none of it worked. But she's been on opioid therapy around 2 decades or close to 2 decades, and that has worked for her. But recently, she has had a more difficult time getting the medication that she needs at the same levels. Part of that is because of regulations in her state of California, and part of it is because doctors are just a little more hesitant, and of course there's research now that shows that opioids don't necessarily help everyone who have chronic pain situations. So you have these different elements coalescing into a situation that ends up being not a great situation for a lot of the patients like Cindy.
Well, we've all heard about the opioid epidemic and the numbers of often very young lives lost to overdoses. So there has been a great deal of legislation and policy changes on the national level, the DEA, the Justice Department, the CDC. What are they doing to curb opioid addiction?
Well, they're doing a lot of things. I mean, the CDC put out some guidelines earlier this year to really advise doctors on how to prescribe opioids safely. And one of the things they said was when it comes to a chronic pain situation, opioids just shouldn't be your first line of defense. You should not routinely prescribe them for chronic pain. These are all regulations that we can sort of debate back and forth, but you do end up with a situation where you have patients who had been dependent on the medication for whatever reason. The estimates are 8 to 12 million people currently on long-term opioids. So you have a real question of what to do with these folks who are already on the medication. So I think part of the issue with the guidelines that concerns people is that it's going to encourage this sort of one-size-fits-all treatment strategy that doesn't necessarily apply to some of the patients with rare conditions.
Which may be actually at the root of this. I mean, you went back through the history of pain treatment, at least for the last 20 years. And give us some context on how pain has been treated historically and its connection to people getting hooked on pain medication.
Yeah, sure. So in the 1990s, I guess is when it really started when the prescribing really started to increase. The American Pain Society had a campaign called the Fifth Vital Sign, where they said, you know, we should treat pain as a vital sign in the same way that we treat blood pressure and pulse and temperature and all those things. And that along with that, you had pharmaceutical companies. Purdue is the main one that's mentioned, that when they released OxyContin around that same time, marketed it very heavily as a cure, a sort of a cure-all for chronic pain. And in a lot of cases, I think doctors took the word of the marketing that they were listening to, and they did overprescribe, and they did for years. And I think we're sort of now coming around to the idea that, well, not just now, but I mean, people are realizing now that overprescribing was an issue, and so now you have the real question of how do you pull back on prescribing while also not throwing out these patients with the bathwater.
Now, several states and also national monitoring of how doctors prescribe or other caregivers prescribe, cracking down on people who've had prescriptions for over 3 months. Why is 3 months the standard?
You know, that's a good question. I think that was the there was a team of medical experts who came up with these guidelines, and the chronic pain was just determined to be anything with pain lasting longer than 3 months. And I think you hit on one of the criticisms that you hear certainly from patients, that the 3 month rules feels arbitrary to them. Again, going back to patients who can expect a lifetime of pain. Putting them in the same category as someone with a broken leg who is expected to heal and not have pain in a few months it doesn't make a whole lot of sense. So to answer why, I'm not really sure how they came up with that number, but that's the number that, you know, the team of experts has sort of decided that was going to be considered chronic.
How is the crackdown on opioids affecting people who deal with chronic pain? Well, reporter and editor Christopher Zara is with us. He found that many of them are suffering and feel stigmatized. Christopher, there is this larger argument here. This is articulated to you by a man named Andrew Kolodny, if I'm saying his name right. He's a big critic of opioid overprescribing. And he says that people with chronic pain have, in effect, become addicts, and their pain is really withdrawal. Can you flesh that out for us and tell us
Sure.
the response?
I think you have a situation with where in a lot of cases you could argue that the people who had been treated shouldn't have been treated with the opioid medication to begin with. So you do have situations where people are either dependent or addicted to this medication they've been on for a long time. In those cases, certainly you can argue that if you took them off the medication, they would experience withdrawal pain. I think the larger question that you know, I think Andrew misses a little bit, and we talked about this, him and I, is how do you decide which patients should be on it and shouldn't be on it in a way that's fair to everyone? When you have such a large group of people with so many different kinds of conditions and so many different manifestations of those pain symptoms, like how do you do it in a way that's fair without, you know, making broad statements like opioids are just lousy drugs for chronic pain, which is one of his, you know, one of his go-to statements. I don't know the answer to that. I think this, and when we talked about it, he admitted, like, that actually is the big challenge. Like, what do you do with all of these different patients, and how do you deal with it in a way that's fair and in a way that looks at them as individuals?
Well, which I guess is part of the stigma that you refer to in the article. Why do these people feel stigmatized?
Yeah, I mean, I think why they feel stigmatized is, you know, there's been a lot of news in the press about this, you know, and rightfully so. I mean, I don't want to say for a second that I want to be very careful about how I say this, because, you know, when I talk about it, sometimes people think I'm making light of the real problem that is out there, and that's the problem of you know, drug abuse and overdoses and addiction and all that stuff. It's very real, and I don't want to say that it's not. I think why people are feeling stigmatized, the patients, is because the narrative now has been so focused on the addiction. I mean, you can imagine if you were on this medication and relied on it, how you would feel every day seeing a new story about the opioid crisis, and here you are, you have them in your medicine cabinet and you rely on them. It's pretty, to me, it's pretty obvious why you would feel stigmatized.
Right. So the difficulty is in distinguishing those who really need these drugs in order to function and have been on them for a long time. Suddenly they're pulled away.
Yeah.
So what kinds of regulation then might make a difference and might make that distinction?
You know, I think that's a really, really good question. It's a tough question. I think part of the answer, I think, lies in the healthcare system itself and the way doctors deal with patients. I heard a lot of stories from patients who just feel they were not getting the individualized treatment that they needed. You walk into a doctor's office, they give you 10 minutes. Sometimes they'll write you a prescription. Sometimes they'll, talk to you, take your blood pressure or whatever, and then you're out. Like, there's not a whole lot of time to deal with the patients who need extra time. So I think part of the answer lies there, and then that gets into a whole discussion about, how broken our healthcare system is and how do we fix it. I certainly don't want to blame, doctors who in many cases are overworked and dealing with their own sets of issues. I mean, in my own personal situation, my doctor just sent me a letter saying he's not going to use insurance anymore. So I can still go to him, but I can't use insurance because it's just so much of a hassle for him that he's done with it. So it's a really big, complex problem. But the answer, I think, lies in figuring out a way to make treatment better for patients who have conditions that, don't fall into a category that's easily treatable.
Christopher Zara, news editor at Fast Company, thank you for speaking with us.
Thank you for having me.
Christopher is also author of the book Tortured Artists, From Picasso and Monroe to Warhol and Winehouse, The Twisted Secrets of the World's Creative Minds. He wrote about how the opioid crisis has stigmatized people with chronic pain in a piece for Vice called Treated Like Addicts. There's a link to read it at wordofmouthradio.org.
Word of mouth.
Word of mouth.
Word of mouth.
Word of mouth.
Word of
mouth.
This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. Pine Point is an Ojibwe village on the White Earth Indian Reservation in northern Minnesota. Their residents live in cheaply built ranch houses. Some are boarded up and covered with gang tags. Cars and trash burn on the streets. It is a place that feels depleted of hope.
I've seen so many lives, young lives, just ruined here because it would be hard for them to go out into the real world. And this is where they were raised up here and everything, and they only learn from what others do. So.
That's a clip from The Seventh Fire, a documentary that follows the cycle of poverty and violence and addiction for two Native American men caught up in the bleak town's gang culture. The film was shot in Pine Point and inside a Minnesota courthouse and prison where many local gang members end up. Jack Riccobono is director of The Seventh Fire film and joins us now from a studio in New York. Hello, Jack.
Hi, Virginia. How's it going? Thanks for having me.
Really glad to have you with us. The film was produced by Terrence Malick, Natalie Portman, and the Native filmmaker Chris Ayer, who also directed Smoke Signals. And Chris is also with us. Chris, welcome to Word of Mouth.
Thanks for having me, Virginia. This is really great.
Well, it's an amazing film, although not exactly a feel-good film, that follows these two men, primarily Kevin Findeay, who's 17, when we meet him anyway, and Rob Brown, 37, about to go to prison for a fifth time. Not sure who wants to pick this up, but maybe you, Jack. How would you describe the relationship between those two?
Yeah, well, Rob is this sort of larger-than-life character who's had a really intense, personal journey. He went through 39 foster families as a child and then in and out of the juvenile system, and then he was in and out of prison four times before I met him and started shooting this project. And, when he was in the system, that's where he sort of got initiated into the gang culture, and he played a role in bringing that gang culture back to the Native village, where he's from in Pine Point. And so what we wanted to do with the story is sort of look at this phenomenon of gang culture migrating from prisons and inner cities out to remote native communities across the country, because it's something that is happening on a pretty widespread basis in Indian country. But we wanted to look at those issues through the very personal and specific stories of Rob and his younger associate, Kevin Findeay, who's at a very different point in the cycle. And the film is really about that push and pull, I think, within Rob between his native identity, which is very strong. I mean, he was raised by his grandfather when he was very young and feels very strongly about his Ojibwe heritage and tradition. But then he also has this gang identity that is very strong within him also, and part of what has allowed him to survive in very difficult circumstances.
And Kevin, his impression of Rob, you know, he's like an OG. Kevin wants to become a big-time drug dealer or doesn't. There's a scene between the two of them where Rob is sort of telling him, don't do it like this, but not really dissuading him. Let's hear just a clip.
I've been in lockup since I was 12 years old. Probably only spent a year and a half out.
You're definitely on your way.
I don't know, man, like, kind of has me thinking twice right now, because they might, if I'm doing good and do all this, they might plea bargain me down to EJJ.
Well, don't be like me and get used to it.
Yeah, I know.
I did 12 years and I got to do 3 more. Get done with this one, I'll have 15.
Yeah, I remember you had long hair last summer.
It'll be longer. See you again, it'll be longer.
So Kevin wants to be a big-time drug dealer, a very different aspiration than his father, who traps and sells leeches for bait. How do people eke out a living here in Pine Point?
Yeah, well, I think what you touched upon is the wealth of this movie, which is it's a difficult movie to watch at some points, but it's really a image of what we are as Americans in this day and age of things shifting so quickly. And a lot of times people, I think they know Native Americans in this country, but these are specifics about people and people that matter. So in this case, it's Rob and Kevin. And when you ask, you know, how do people support themselves by, you know, selling leeches in Pine Point? Well, I mean, this is an example of the Americana that we live in. And I think that's what this movie touches upon. It touches upon what we think we already know, but certainly we need those examples of what's happening today right next door to us in order for them to be relevant and important to all of us and for all of us to learn about each other.
Well, Chris, you directed Smoke Signals. This was the first commercially distributed film written and directed by a Native filmmaker, focused on like the small, you know, the little domestic realities of a couple of different characters, but a much different feeling than the kind of dead end feeling of Pine Point. So what drew you to this film?
Well, I wouldn't characterize it as a dead end. I think that, you know, Jack and I laughed a few times about, you know, the stereotypes or the perceived stereotypes that the movie has in it or portrays. And, you know, stereotypes, I always laugh, and we were laughing, are stereotypes for a reason, because they in part have some truth to them. So in this case, you know, things right in front of us are stereotypical, but they're also reality that is something that's not stereotypical, because when you add a real person such as Kevin and Rob is this charismatic 6'3", 250-pound, you know, four-time convict that's very stereotypical for, you know, somebody in his society. But on the other hand, you know, he's so charismatic in his humor, in his writing, in his poetry, in his work as an artist, and he literally comes out of that stereotype onto the screen. And he's somebody that you want to watch. And that's the thing that drew me to this movie was I watched, you know, some of the cut with Jack the first time. And I said, who is this character? Who is this person? And I think that's what delivers us into caring about, you know,
individuals and other people.
Well, I'm curious about what you mean by stereotypes, because, you know, Kevin himself says, nothing's ever going to change here. You know, I'm never going to get out of here. No one's going to come in. And Rob says, you know, I don't want to go back to jail again, but I'm going. So that's what I meant by dead end. I'm not sure what you mean by stereotypes.
You know, there's a stereotype, of course, about addiction, and you know, people think that they know the struggles that are going on the reservation when it comes to alcoholism or drug addiction. And a lot of the times we see that, if we see anything at all, we see these terrible headlines and statistics about life on the reservation. But you rarely see any type of contemporary story about Native life on the reservation that really shows you humanity and goes further than those sort of surface level statistics.
Well, let's get a little sense of Rob. His Indian name is Two Thunderbirds. He has a Native gangster disciple sign on his chest. And in the film finds out he has just a week before he has to go back to prison for his fifth time. We see him on camera. He's kind of strutting into the courtroom. Then he's sitting there in his lawyer's office reading through his record, wearing handcuffs.
Defendant stated after he began running away, he became a ward of the state and spent the next 10 years going through a gambit of foster homes. Defendant reported he could recall somewhere around 39 different foster homes and 3 group homes. Defendant further stated that while in various foster care settings, he was abused both physically, sexually. He reported he had informed his caseworker at the time of the incident, but did not feel that anything actually came from his reports.
Well, clearly this is not an excuse for his criminal behavior, but what does this scene tell us about him as a character?
That was one of the things that stopped me when I watched the movie, was 39 foster care homes. And I'm thinking to myself, you know, at 25, shouldn't there be some alert that goes off? Or is that alert at 50? And I'm, you know, being sarcastic and saying that. I don't know what happens or what happens to the person when they go through the instability of 39 foster care homes. So I applaud Rob as an individual for being as tenacious as he is. And like you said, it doesn't condone any behavior, but certainly I think we have to look at it and say, okay, what's going on here? And, you know, I also connect that to what's going on, you know, in North Dakota with the pipeline issue, in which people are getting, you know, felony charges put against them for peaceful protesting. And, you know, there's not a rule book on what people should do when the governor of North Dakota has never been in this situation. But ultimately what happens is, and in this case with the seventh fire, people's needs aren't being met. And I think that at the very best, what we do as Americans is we have to figure out what those needs are, and we have to help those situations. And this movie, by bringing questions to light, is you know, helping that cause and effect, I hope.
Well, in the film, Kevin, the young man, pretty well on the path to follow Rob into prison. He goes to rehab. He sees some promise. He gets released and reaches out to a man who heads La Plazita Institute. This is a gang interventionist who goes into jails and schools and says, culture can heal. So Kevin, desperate, grasping, gives him a call, knows it would be good for him not to go back to P-Town and to that culture that he already knows. Let's hear just a little bit from that phone call.
Have you ever been here? La Plazita?
I haven't even been out of the state of Minnesota. I feel just trapped in this place where I live. I feel like I can't get away. It'll be more of an opportunity or something. Like, I'm not trying to feed no, like, BS or anything. Every time, it doesn't last me very long until I'm right back in again. So
again, you know, we're here to support you.
I'll be looking forward to this. Like, I didn't think I was gonna jump right into it when I got out, but have more of a chance of getting to it as quick as possible than sitting out here and trying to figure shit out for my life.
All right. Well, that's it. That's all we're going to ask is if you're willing to try it, brother. You know, maybe we'll see you this summer. We're headed up to the powwow.
Yeah, me too.
All right, man. Take care. Be careful.
Yeah, you too.
All right. Later.
Yeah, later.
That's from The Seventh Fire. I'm speaking with the director and producer, co-writer and co-cinematographer Jack Riccobono, and also with Chris Eyre, who is one of the producers of the film. So La Plazita promises that culture can heal. What is that culture now for someone like Kevin?
I think Indian culture is reconnecting with your traditional ways, your language, your ceremony, your creation stories. And I think that that's one method, but it's a method of really going into yourself and really giving yourself the sense of identity and pride that a young person, regardless of you know, them being Native or not, needs. And so in Kevin's case, I think that, you know, those are some of the things that are missed along the way in the fast-paced world, you know, where we have so much information being passed. And with Native culture, it seems to be, at least in the overculture, a secondary importance.
We see in this film, you know, two generations of Native life, even three if you count the children of Rob. Rob, older, seemingly more aware of his heritage. But in Kevin's case, you know, just turning 18, in his home he has Scarface posters, he wears very hip-hop clothes, you know, has a totally fly haircut. So what does that mean? How is that playing out for him and for Rob in this story?
Yeah, well, you know, I mean, I think that speaks to some of what Chris is talking about of trying to find your place in the overculture. And, you know, in the trailer for The Seventh Fire, we feature a hip-hop song by an Ojibwe rapper named Tall Paul, where he actually raps in the Ojibwe language. And, you know, I think that's a really interesting example of cultural change, you know, where you can embrace your heritage and also find new positive expressions for it. For Kevin and Rob, you know, I think it's still a developing story. I mean, you know, Rob, as I mentioned, you know, does have a stronger kind of cultural base from the teachings he received from his grandfather. And in the film, when he does go back to prison, he has something of a cultural awakening where he really wants to go back and learn his own language, and he begins to write again. And, you know, he wrote many poems during his incarceration that he would mail to me. He would, you know, tear them out of his journal and mail me these handwritten pages. And we ended up creating a book of his work called White Earth Stories. And, you know, I think in those poems, you can see him grappling with this cultural push and pull and trying to find his voice. And, you know, I think one of the most you know, inspirational moments for us in making the film was being able to present it at the White House in March. And both Rob and Kevin came with us and sat on a panel after the screening with, you know, journalists and academics and federal officials and spoke their stories, you know, in the heart and the center of power in our country. And that was just incredibly powerful to hear them share their truth in that setting.
I know this film gives us a glimpse into the lives of two people and the people who are affected by them and around them. But when I watched it, I felt like it's standing in for something much bigger because they are Native Americans, because they are living in this remote, near desolate place, thinking about the betrayal by the American government, the history of people of great dignity and how that has changed throughout American history. So is that unfair? Is that sort of lifting too much?
No, I don't think so. I mean, the film is certainly about Rob and Kevin, but I think it speaks to these much larger issues, and that's what we were hoping to create when we made it. I mean, it's a very personal journey that you're on with Rob and Kevin, but I think, you know, certainly, you know, you're bringing your own consciousness of that history to watching it, and we hope that people will see those layers in the film. I mean, you see a 4th of July parade in the border town right on the White Earth border. And, you know, it's this totally white Minnesota experience with flags and very patriotic. And, you know, so you see this enter into the film. And, you know, I think that what part of the point of it is to not think of this as ancient history. You know, I mean, these fights, and that's what really the Dakota Access Pipeline protests are showing us as well. You know, these are not settled issues, you know, treaty rights, you know, fighting for the environment, fighting for native rights. These are not things that are ancient history. These are battles that are playing out right now, on a personal level, and I think on a much larger level.
Jack Riccobono, he is director, co-writer, and co-cinematographer of the documentary film The Seventh Fire. Thank you for speaking with us.
Thanks for having us.
He's also co-producer along with Chris Eyre. Chris, thank you very much for joining us.
Thanks for having us, Virginia.
You can watch a trailer of the film, which is now streaming on Netflix and also available on iTunes at wordofmouthradio.org. This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. In New England, we love to talk about the weather. Just this month, we've had a taste of the region's wintry mix, that euphemism that meteorologists use that sounds a little bit like just giving up. In just a week, we had a Monday morning storm and drivers slipping on black ice, an icy Arctic blast, and then a almost spring-like day when the ground got mucky and the temperature climbed toward 50 degrees. As much as we grumble about its unpredictability, we can rely on a few things. The particular silence of snow falling in the dark, the low thunder of snowplows, and the crack of ice underfoot. That is the wintry mix that got NHPR's North Country reporter thinking about snow, something he's actually been doing for a long, long time. Here's Sean Hurley with a little ode to frozen H2O.
In third grade, as the first snow fell, the teacher had us go to the window to watch it, to get it out of our systems, she said. And then, maybe because that didn't work, she announced that we were going to do a little project. For the next 20 minutes, we were going to write down 20 different ways to describe snow. She wrote, "Snow is... dot dot dot" on the chalkboard. So I wrote, 1. Snow is... cold. 2. Snow is... wet. 3. Snow is white. And suddenly right then, all those exactly good words seemed exactly wrong. Everyone knew snow was wet and white and cold, so I erased those words and wrote snow is dot 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 17 more times. And then looking over the page, I had the chilly insight that nothing else should be added, that this lack of description, this snow is dot dot dot, written 20 times over, was the best work I'd ever done. I passed in my empty assignment and heard nothing back. Whether I failed or not, I'd like to complete the assignment now. Snow is, both brush and dust. It sweeps as it falls, cleans as it covers. Snow is, a lightly sugared iron, a teaspoon down the middle of the tongue. Snow is, the once upon a time of weather. Every snowflake, a dislodged coordinate, a glass second from a century ago. Snow is like a bed over the land, mattress thick and layered with soft cotton sheets and rumpled comforters, but this bed sleeps on us. Snow is a photographer. If any bird lands, if any stick falls, its picture is taken. What is here is what was also just here. Snow is one part moonlight, one part wind. Snow is fingerprints falling down. And the last 13 I'll borrow from my third grade self. Because I don't know that I was wrong, and maybe that emptiness was the best work I've ever done. Snow is. Snow is. Snow is.
And that was NHPR's Sean Hurley, always able to summon a bit of holiday spirit for even the scroogiest of Scrooges. We noticed he avoided the description of snow in March, when it's piled in dirty brown crags on wet, sandy parking lots and stuck into tire treads like a frozen mudslide sloshed on the street.
we invite you to share your description of snow with us, the lovely and puffy and the otherwise. You can do it on Twitter. Our handle is at word of mouth. There's really no other way to say this, but we're out of time for today. Thank you so much for listening. Music in this episode came to us from Jazar, Poddington Bear, Blue Dot Sessions, Tyler Gibbons, and Red Heart the Ticker. There's so much more to hear and explore at wordofmouthradio.org, and you can download the Word of Mouth podcast on iTunes or Google Play. And please keep in touch with us. We're on Facebook at Word of Mouth Radio and on Twitter at Word of Mouth. I'm Virginia Prescott. We'll be back with more Word of Mouth tomorrow at 2, right here on NHPR.
Word of Mouth is produced by Molly Donahue, Logan Shannon,
and Jimmy Gutierrez.
Our senior producer is
Taylor Quimby,
and our executive producer is Maureen McMurray.
The views expressed in this program are those of the individuals
and not those of NHPR,
its board of trustees,
or its underwriters. Word of Mouth is a production
of New Hampshire Public Radio.
Thank you.